Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with my friend, Pastor Bob Thune of Cormdale Church. Pastor Chris Hemmelman is not with us, but on Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're tackling the question, does Christian love require open borders?
Hey, we have had this question has actually been teed up by a number of listeners. For the past 2 years, people have been emailing us and saying, hey, would you talk about like how should we think about immigration? And I've always thought that was a really good question, and I've kind of put it on the back burner. Recently, Brad Littlejohn wrote a piece in First Things that's titled A Theology of Immigration. And I was like, oh, great, he's done the work for us. Let's just talk about this article. So before we dive into the topic of borders and immigration, we need to give a shout out for snacks once again to our amazing operations assistant, Katrina from Kazakhstan. I feel like Katrina is trying to like put forward all the best Russian items and just say like, hey, I want you guys to try this. It's like she wants us to be like waving the Russia flag on this podcast or trying to disciple us into
She's trying.
So what she brought today is kvass. It's a beverage. How would you describe that container, Dusty?
It looks like a root beer keg.
Yeah, it looks like a root beer keg. It's a liter and a half. All the language is in the Cyrillic alphabet, Russian. It's called kvass. And I said, Katrina, how would you describe kvass? What is this that we're drinking? And she said, it's between kombucha and root beer.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's helpful. And then literally, Dusty, when I tasted it, I was like, I don't think you could describe it better Perfect. Than that. It's not sweet enough to be root beer. It's not vinegary enough to be kombucha.
The label that
I
read
worse
here
than both
says that it's fermented soft drink. So it's kind of like drinking for the Midwest folks, it's like a flat.
She
soda.
Said, yeah, she said it's fermented rye bread or something like that. So it's like, it's an odd beverage. I don't know if I think what we both decided as we tasted it is I don't hate it.
No,
I don't love it.
No.
It's not terrible. It's not great.
If I passed this in the store, I would definitely keep passing. I'd walk. But it's tasty.
Yeah. So thank you, Katrina, for the kvass, which will quench our thirst during this episode about borders and immigration. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize the article as best I can, kind of walk through the contours of it. We will post a link to the article at the First Things website if listeners want to go read it for themselves. I think Brad Littlejohn is doing us a good service here, and I'll walk you through the argument he makes, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. So here's where he starts. In the book Dominion, Tom Holland's very excellent book that a lot of people have referenced, the subtitle is How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. Holland makes the point that the willingness of Western nations to open their borders to the huddled masses at their doorsteps is imaginable only because of Christianity. Throughout human history, almost no one other than Christians has felt this way. Outsiders remain outside, and that is that. Christianity, however, has always offered a vision of radical hospitality, tearing down ethnic boundaries was at the heart of St. Paul's gospel. So he's saying, hey, Holland makes the point that openness to the outsider is part of the heritage of Christianity. He asks then, why then do so many evangelical Christians today intuit that something is wrong with Angela Merkel's reasoning? Merkel, of course, is the leader of Germany who opened the borders wide to a lot of immigrants and has faced a lot of backlash for that over the past few years. Is the call for control of the border simply a nativist reflex that we must stifle? A manifestation of sinful pride and selfishness that we must mortify? Or does the globalist war on borders constitute rather an idolatrous striving to transcend our finitude, to be as gods unbound in time or space? Here's Brad Littlejohn's thesis. In my estimation, secure borders, national sovereignty, and limited immigration are affirmed by traditional Christian moral theology. Of course, there's nothing sacred about lines on a map. They are human constructions which serve human goods. But these goods, the goods of hearth and homeland, are not to be despised, for without them, we would lose our humanity. Little John is cluing you in that he is going to make an argument for limited immigration and secure borders. And what I like is he is succumbing neither to the sort of, if you're a real Christian, you should let anybody in all the time, nor to sort of the hostile, let's keep everybody out and build a wall. He is somewhere in between those things, but he does believe that Christian moral theology leads us to respect national sovereignty, secure borders, and limited immigration. So he starts by pointing out, hey, in this debate, the language of hospitality is what you often hear by the progressive side of the conversation. They say, hey, if we're going to practice hospitality, if we're going to be Christian and be hospitable like Jesus taught, that means openness to immigrants. It means we open our arms wide to the stranger, to the poor, to those who are without a home. And so he says, hey, that's a meaningful case. But does the appeal to hospitality entail a call to abolish or open our borders? He's saying, does the fact that we talk about hospitality mean we just have to have a wide open border? And then he gives us this example that I thought this is the most helpful analogy in the article.
Yeah, it's very helpful to me when I was reading this. I'm along for the ride, and always on immigration, I'm like, I just can't get my head all the way around it. And then this analogy of house and home are very helpful.
So here's what he writes. To show hospitality in my own home, I must have a home. That is a house with four walls and doors that open, close, and ideally can be locked. To invite people into this home, I must maintain a clear distinction between residents and guests. If every passing drug addict can crash on the couch, I may be running a worthy ministry, but I am not maintaining a home. In fact, if I have children, I will know instinctively that I must sometimes put their needs above the practice of hospitality. Some strangers will be too dangerous to allow into my home. Others may be safe enough, but they will compete for the limited temporal and financial resources that I owe to my wife and children before all others. Of course, a residence totally closed to neighbors and strangers would likewise be a travesty. It might be a beautiful house, but we would rightly hesitate to call it a home. Hospitality, then, is an essential function of a home, and yet an unlimited revolving door hospitality would quickly destroy most homes. The lesson is clear enough. A nation, likewise, ought to be open to strangers, but it will soon have little to offer either residents or visitors if it does not establish appropriate limits. A nation without borders is like a house without walls. Common sense shows us that, like every creaturely good, hospitality is made possible only by recognition of its limits. You said that was really helpful as an analogy.
It's helpful because it makes sense, you know? Like, I lock my doors at night, not because I'm not hospitable, but because it's just wise and safe, right?
Yeah.
And then I think where sometimes the immigration argument can go is like just limitless everything, right? And we live in this world right now where everything should be limitless. And so he's saying, no, you have limits on your home.
You got to embrace it.
You're going to be smart.
Now, to make his case, he wants to first of all take us to Scripture, and he points to two things. First, in the Old Testament, Israel is made up of families and tribes. Each family and tribe has its particular portion and inheritance, quoting now from the article, to be secured throughout the generations, yet this possession serves a wider good. The surplus of each Israelite's fields is for the poor and the sojourner, as is the surplus of the whole nation. The Bible's account of Israel's norms for treating strangers tells us at least that the call to hospitality does not abolish property lines or territorial distinctions. So in the Old Testament, you have, hey, you're responsible for your ancestral property, but you're supposed to let the sojourner glean in your fields. You're supposed to honor the poor with your harvest. And so you see this combination of private property, private ownership, and yet hospitality and generosity toward the poor. In the New Testament, possessing wealth is permitted, so long as property is ordered toward the goods of hospitality and charity. Little John points to the debate between Christian socialists who say, hey, in the New Testament, Acts 2 is the model, and you know, everybody is supposed to have everything in common, and the most pure Christian society should be sort of like a socialist society where no one has any private property. However, he argues that in most of the rest of the New Testament, property is taken for granted. You have Ananias and Sapphira bringing a tithe to the Lord and lying about it in Acts chapter 5. You have the statement in 1 Timothy 5 that if anyone doesn't provide for the needs of his own household, he's denied the faith and he's worse than an unbeliever. So he says, you have private property in the Bible, but you have this expectation that the reason, as a Christian, the reason God has given you resource is first so that you can be responsible with it for those who are dependent on you, and then so that you can be generous with those in need. Now, he spends some time in the article walking through the tradition, the Christian tradition. He draws out two themes: that there's sort of a more pessimistic view of private property among the church fathers and of political authority. They're a little skeptical that, like, yeah, it's because of sin that you have private property. In the idea in Eden, we would have had no reason for people to put up a fence or to own land or to call anything theirs. Sort of the ideal vision of society would be one where everything belongs to everyone. But he draws out Thomas Aquinas, who has a more optimistic view of both property and authority. And he argues, Aquinas argues, that even in Eden, even if the fall into sin would never have happened, as the world grew, as population increased, you would have had responsibility for people to steward creation and to use it for the good of others. Quoting now again from the article, "The use of external things is given to all men in common, and yet in order that the goal of common use may be best achieved, it is generally more effective that individuals be given the right or the responsibility to administer a certain portion of the world's goods for their own use and that of others. Private property thus serves the greater end of overall prosperity and well-being for all." So he says, in our tradition, as Protestants and as Christians, we have a wide berth of understanding here. And we have key figures like Thomas Aquinas who clarify that ownership of property is not greedy. It's not sinful, as long as it's understood that I steward this for the good of others. So Brad Littlejohn is now going to apply this to the question of borders. So sorry, he's been building a theological argument, a biblical argument. Now he's going to get to the question of borders, and you're going to see him come back to that metaphor of a house. Okay? "A nation, like a family," writes Littlejohn, "exists not for itself alone, but for the sake of all. And yet, because of human finitude, to exist for others, a nation must first exist for itself. It must cultivate a commonwealth, just as a family must secure private wealth. A nation must define the boundaries that distinguish between residents, who enjoy a primary claim to its resources, and neighbors, who have only a secondary claim. Just as a family that never opens its home to others less fortunate has failed to understand its calling as a family, so a nation that offers no hospitality to outsiders would rightly be judged as xenophobic. Yet in both cases, that hospitality must be carefully measured out, lest the family or nation dissolve under the burden of too many guests, and those welcomed become dependent in a way that corrupts their characters." You notice he's coming back to that home metaphor and just saying, if you just think about your house and what it means for you to practice hospitality, you will see that if you never have anyone over, then you're a xenophobe, you're selfish. But if you always have people over, you don't have a house, you don't have a home. You know, there's no refuge, there's no place of responsibility. And the same applies to a nation. And you can see that Littlejohn here is building a case for limited immigration. He's saying you shouldn't have a closed border, but it's absolutely common sense wisdom to have limits on immigration, to have boundaries, to have a border that's patrolled, to have a mechanism by which you welcome people in the same way that you would in your house. And his distinction between residents and neighbors is a helpful distinction. You know, we've got these neighbor boys three houses down the street, and man, sometimes they just come over and just walk in my front door.
Yeah.
And when they do that, I'm like, hey guys, I love you. You may not just walk in my house. Like, there's a doorbell for a reason. So you can ring the doorbell. You can knock on my door. You may not just come in. You don't live here. And what I'm trying to reinforce with these boys is, hey, I'm a hospitable neighbor. I enjoy y'all, but you don't live here. You're not a resident. Only residents just get to walk in. Now, you may have different social norms around how you let neighbors in and how they let you know that they want to come in. But the point is, all of us understand the difference between someone who's in my family and a neighbor or a person who lives next door or a friend I'm having over. There's a different kind of relationship and a different kind of responsibility that's there.
And usually those people know who they are. You know, even the neighbor kid knows that they don't live there. So yeah. It's okay to have some boundary. It's okay to have some limits. It's a different type of relationship. Just like the hospitality piece. It's okay. You should be having people over for meals. If you have somebody over for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day of the week, well,
they kind of live there.
Yeah, that's different, you know?
Now, I think for most listeners, what Brad Littlejohn is putting forward, you'd say like, yeah, that feels common sense. I think that a Christian understanding of immigration would say we should have immigration, but there should be some kind of boundaries or limits on it. Brad Littlejohn then wants to ask the question, why is the conclusion that we may and perhaps must limit immigration so hard to voice in polite company?
Yeah.
Why in many churches are arguments for enforcing borders greeted with an appalled gasp? Why is there this assumption in Christianity that if you believe in any kind of limits on immigration, you're not applying the gospel, you're not living out Christian convictions? Conservatives, says Littlejohn, bear some of the blame for the righteous rage. An uncharitable and godless brand of nativism comes easily to fallen humans. And so he's saying there's like a nativist, ethnocentric, ethno-nationalist kind of impulse in this conversation that Christians have given ground to. And so we bear some of the blame when we have allowed that way of thinking to be present in our churches or in our own hearts. He writes, however, compassion is not the only virtue. In fact, it frequently blinds us to the hard task of prudential judgment to which we are constantly called. I think that's helpful because what the thing you generally hear, especially in response to nativism, is hey, we have to have compassion for people who are refugees. They're coming from places in the world where things are falling apart. They want to come into America. We should be compassionate. We should let them in. He's saying compassion is not the only virtue. In fact, there's another virtue called prudential judgment. And this is the place where Littlejohn is applying some really foundational biblical political theology in a way that I find very helpful. He writes, ultimately, the progressive demand for open borders partakes of the progressive refusal to exercise judgment. Judgment demands the forgotten virtue of discrimination. Our culture today refuses to discern that a marital union differs from casual sex, or that a man differs from a woman. To insist on the boundaries between girls' and boys' sports is now deemed sheer bigotry in many circles. Why? Because any boundary, any limit, is experienced as an intolerable barrier to our exercise of the transcendent godlike freedom that modern man demands. That's an amazing statement.
Yeah. And what's interesting about the statement, Bob, and I'd be curious for you to speak a little bit more about this. He's calling us to exercise judgment, which we do not talk about.
Yeah, no one talks about that.
We want to avoid judgment. We have only bad things to say about being judgy.
Right.
But here he's saying, no, it's actually biblical and good and virtuous.
Yes.
To exercise judgment.
And so if you remember, compassion, I think, is an easier virtue for people to recognize because it's so central in Jesus' teaching. I mean, Jesus talks about caring for the poor, caring for the widow. You know, the story where everybody's putting their offerings in the temple treasury and the widow puts in her two pennies and Jesus says she gave more than all these other people because she gave out of her lack, out of all she had. And so there's so much in Jesus' teaching to commend compassion.
Well, and compassion tugs at me easier too.
Yes. Right?
Like it just pulls me in.
Yes. But prudence has always been understood as one of the classical virtues. Prudence is another name for wisdom or discernment or discretion. And prudence requires that I distinguish. So think about the book of Proverbs, Dusty.
Yeah.
And think about like the company of, you know, he who runs with fools will suffer harm. What that's teaching you to do is to say, okay, I need to discern the character of the people I'm hanging out with. And if I'm hanging out with fools, I need to realize it's not going to go well. And then the proverb goes on to say, he who walks with the wise will himself be wise, right? So Proverbs is meant to teach us the importance of making prudential judgments. Is this person I'm lending money to going to pay it back? Or have they proven that they're a person who's untrustworthy for that, and so I'm going to not lend them money, right? These are the kinds that when Brad Littlejohn uses the language of common sense, he's using the language of Proverbs, the language of wisdom, the language of prudence. The idea is all of us know that we have to learn life in this way. We have to realize here's a wise friend, here's a foolish friend. Here's a trustworthy person, here's an untrustworthy person. Here's a safe person, here's a dangerous person. Here's an addict, not going to invite them over for dinner. Here's a needy kid that lives next door, want to have him over for dinner, right? We're always making these kinds of judgments about who can I afford to invest in? Who do I feel God calling me to invest in? What distinctions do I see that I need to make in life in order to live out the calling to compassion that God has given me? Again, to use the addict example, right? There are some people in the church who are called to have ministries to addicts and help them recover, and that's a good and gracious thing. That's different than saying, I want an addict leading my four-year-old class in Sunday school, right? It's just like, yeah. Well, there's a different category for how someone who's right now in the grip of an addiction, we want them in certain rooms. We want to set certain boundaries about what other rooms would we allow them in. In the same way, well, I guess what I'm giving there is just a bunch of different examples of what this idea of prudence looks like. And all Littlejohn is saying is, it's easy for us to talk about compassion. We often don't talk about prudence as a virtue. And prudence requires making judgments. It requires discerning and discriminating and saying, you know, here's a wise person, here's a foolish person, here's a person we would let into our country or into our home. Here's a boundary we would set around. Why would we set the boundary here or there?
So why do you think it's so hard for Christians, like, to track right there with your proverb stuff? Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, of course, we're all doing that. We're all making those judgment moves. But when it comes to immigration, now I just feel like a jerk.
Well, let me suggest three reasons. One, because all of us are living in the moment that we're living in. And we're living in a moment where there is we have an affluent country. We have a lot of wealth. We know that we're very privileged. We know that a lot of the world is less privileged. And we're living on the heels of about 8 or 9 years in our national politics where immigration has been a hot issue and people have not always spoken with wisdom and prudence about it. You had Donald Trump in 2016, the whole election saying he was going to build a wall, which many people felt like, man, that's kind of like an extreme version of a border policy. You know, it was like build a wall all the way across the thing. But then the counterpoint to that among the progressive movement was, let's just let everybody in.
Yeah.
And so because we've all been influenced by that backstory, I think there's a tendency among Christians to think, man, if I think there should be any limits on immigration, it feels unloving. It feels uncharitable. Because how would I decide who should get in and who shouldn't?
Yeah.
I think there's also probably a reality for many of us, Dusty, like we have family members or friends of like, this person's not been let into the country, or I have a sister-in-law who married a guy from somewhere and he had to get a green card. And so we know the pain of what a pain it is to go through an immigration process, even in the best economy or policy. And so for most of us, we realize like, man, it's bureaucratic, it's onerous, it's difficult. And I think it's just kind of an easier Christian response to say, well, man, open borders, that seems, you know, all immigrants should be allowed in. That seems like the most charitable, the most loving posture.
Yeah, and we know that that system's broken too. We know people who have suffered underneath the clunkiness of that system. Right.
What I appreciate that Little John is helping us think about is to say, no, actually love, charity, the ability to actually serve immigrants requires that we have borders in the same way that the requirement to practice hospitality requires that I have a house with walls. And if I don't have a place to have people over, I can't have people. If I don't have a kitchen table for you to sit at, I can't have you over for dinner very well. And I think he's helping us think in a more nuanced way about the reality that limits on immigration are a common sense part of applying wisdom in the world God has given us. I think this article is also very wise in the sense that he says, look, I realize that every border is just a line drawn by a human being. Like God, you know, God didn't draw the borders. Like, you know, why is the border with Mexico where it is? Well, because we made a treaty and here's where we drew the lines. You know, he's saying a national border is not like a hard and fast line in objective reality, but it is a way by which nations create boundaries and by which people define, here's where we live and here's the policies and laws and political system that governs this territory. And we realize that in itself is a good. And what Little John is helping us preserve as Christians and helping us theologically think about is, why should there be any border at all? See, I think if you take the argument to the extreme, if you say we should have an open border, there should be no limit on immigration. The next question I would ask is like, well, why should we have a border then? Like, why wouldn't the whole world just be one big country? Maybe we have some different languages there and whatever, but just like, why would we have any border? And the answer is the reason we have borders is because nations have taken shape in history in different ways and have coalesced together around something that defines them as a nation, some set of laws, some set of culture, some set of relationships. And that's how the world has come together. And what Brad Littlejohn is helping us remember is, and that's under the sovereignty of God. Like that's not an evil, a border is not an evil thing or a good thing. It's just a thing that exists in the world.
Right.
And because it exists, we have a responsibility to care about the thriving of our nation. We are citizens of a particular part of the world and not another part of the world. If we lived somewhere else, we'd have a different kind of responsibility for that place. But where we live, we have a responsibility for our household, if you want to think of it that way. Let me read to you a couple of the closing paragraphs, and then we'll continue to sort of just land the plane here. In a world of fallen men, all borders will reflect a checkered history. They were not drawn by angels, but as finite creatures, we must live in accord with them. Sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof. Christ warns those who wring their hands about the future. The same warning applies to those who wring their hands about the past. Our Christian duty is to use the goods God has given us and the commonwealth he has given us to care as best we can, first for our own and then for our neighbors and the needy of every society. Only prudence can determine the appropriate degree of hospitality. How often should the professor have college students over for dinner? Should a family take in a foster child or even adopt? Even for my own family, I cannot answer questions such as these in the abstract. The answer now may be different 5 years from now. So each nation must decide how many visitors or immigrants to admit, weighing its own need for security, prosperity, and cultural cohesion. Even the most philanthropic soul must consider limits. In order to offer the best home for native-born and immigrants alike over the long term, strict limits on the number of newcomers may be necessary. The call to accept our finitude and work within the constraints of prudence can easily be misheard as a call for moral resignation, but it is not. Rather, It asks us to open our hands to the gifts and burdens that providence has placed upon us. In a world without God, we are apt to think that every good and every evil under the sun is a product of our own decisions. But shouldering such an impossible moral burden is not humility, but pride. The meandering line in the desert that marks our southern border was placed there not only by human treaty, but also by God, the disposer of all human affairs. It marks the contours of the particular task to which God has called us as a distinct nation, the task of governing well. The debate over immigration will continue among American Christians, and it should. But it will bear fruit in actionable policy only if conducted with a grateful acceptance of the homeland God has given us to steward. The best takeaway for listeners, I think, is Brad Littlejohn's metaphor of a house and what does it mean for you to practice hospitality? And just saying that's what a nation is. A nation is a home, and as such, it should practice hospitality, but that hospitality is going to have limits. And I think one of the things people feel, Dusty, to go back to the question you asked a few minutes ago, is, man, if we set any limits, like we're saying some people can't come. And I'm saying, yeah, and you do the same thing when you invite your neighbor over and not me, Dusty. Like you you had some neighbor kids over for dinner last night, but you didn't invite me. So right. Why are you being such a jerk? Why aren't you practicing hospitality? Well, you would say, I am practicing hospitality. I can't have everybody over.
Yep.
I don't have room for that. I don't have space for that. I don't have resource for that. And so the challenge of prudence here is to say, yep. So if you say, hey, we're going to let 100,000 immigrants in every year, and here's the criteria of who we're going to let in. You know, people with these work skills or people from this country or people from, you know, people in religious freedom situations. There's all kinds of criteria that countries use. But at the end of the day, that's the problem. It's like, you got to have some criteria. You got to have some boundaries. And every one of us has to embrace the fact that it is impossible for any nation to have unlimited immigration and to still be able to maintain a sense of its responsibilities to its own citizens.
This conversation is really helpful for me because even as I think about my own hospitality, I'm always thinking, okay, how could I be more generous? How could I be more hospitable? How could I build a bigger table and not necessarily like a taller fence as I get older?
That's right? Good. I like that metaphor.
And so, well, I'm ripping it off from somewhere. I heard that somewhere. So how do I do that? And at the same time, understand, okay, there's limits. You know, I can't do it all. We can be generous, but we can't be generous to everybody, right? Because then we'll be out and that would not be responsible.
Right. I could spend my entire grocery budget tonight having my whole neighborhood over, but then my kids would starve for the rest of the month.
Yeah.
And it's not good stewardship.
Yeah.
One of the things that I appreciate about this article is I think it's just helping us think in a more nuanced way about this question. As he says at the end of the article, look, this debate's going to go on. The debate over immigration is an important debate. Christians should have it. Our nation should have it. It's important, but it's important that we have it with nuance and that we have a meaningful sense of, yeah, having limits on immigration does not mean you're a hater. It doesn't mean you're a xenophobe. It doesn't mean you're selfish. It doesn't mean you're a nationalist. It's a reality of life in the world.
Right.
And that metaphor of home helps us. And going back to that, the mention he made of freedom, one of the idolatries we have to confront in American culture is the idolatry that says any kind of limits you place on anything is restrictive.
Yeah.
That's a lie. That's not true.
Yeah.
There's something in us that believes that unless we're free to do everything all the time without any boundaries or limits, then it's not real freedom. But all of us know that's not actually what freedom looks like. That kind of freedom doesn't exist in the world. And so that radical autonomy, that sense of radical, like I should have radical permission to do whatever I want, whenever I want, what it rejects is the reality of created limits.
Yeah.
It's a way of rejecting Genesis 1. I don't live in a created world and I'm not a finite person. And downstream from that is the assumption that we should have unlimited. Yep. There shouldn't be any boundaries or limits on anything, including immigration. And so for Christians, embracing our finitude, our limitation, our inability to do everything, mm-hmm. our limited resources, is important to our conversations and thinking about immigration, because just like your family doesn't have unlimited resources, neither does any country in the world. And so every country is going to have some boundaries and restrictions and limitations. That's right and good. It's biblical. It's not unloving. It's not unjust. It's not unkind. And that needs to factor into this conversation within the church about immigration. So again, we'll link the article in the show notes. I hope this has been a thought provoker to you. I think a lot of listeners have this question because we've been asked to talk about this quite frequently. So I hope that, especially in an election year where you're going to hear a lot about the border, because you know parties are going to be fighting over what's the right approach to the border, I hope this grounds you in a firm and biblical understanding of why limits on immigration are okay, and they're not unjust and unkind and unloving. And also, I hope that this stretches you to open your thinking in either direction, whether you need to move toward a more generous view of hospitality or a more limited view of hospitality. Hope it stretches you in either direction the way that you need to be stretched. So thanks for engaging this topic with us. And again, the article is in the June-July issue of First Things, and so we'll link the link to the article in the show notes.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.